So welcome again. It was really sweet and kind of poignant to be here. So appreciating the invitation and also recognizing that some of you have never seen me before, and some of you have literally kind of watched me grow up in the Dharma to the extent that that's happened. So there's a whole range here, and I've been a part of SIMS in some way since 2003, when I was living and working at Cloud Mountain and met Rodney there. So in some form, I've been involved since then. And a few weeks ago, Tueri asked me to sub for her to come in and give a talk on Wise View, the first path factor of the Eightfold Path, and my eyes completely swelled shut. I woke up and they were completely swollen shut. So psychoanalyze that. But, and so then for this talk on why speech, I said, okay, why speech? I love this topic. And my throat from the smoke is really irritated. So for whatever reason, I'm somaticizing these topics. So anyway, that's a little preamble. But I'm really delighted to be here, and I think I'd like to start by maybe having you just speak to each other for just a moment. I know this is kind of against protocol, but just since we're going to be talking about listening and speaking tonight, so just for a moment, because this, you know, if nothing else, this kind of environmental thing that's happening is rather intense at the moment for many of us. So maybe just take a minute and just introduce yourself to the person next to you and just say, keep it simple, but maybe say one or two true things about your present moment's experience. Just what are you noticing? So keeping it really simple, just take a couple minutes. So you might just notice what that brought up in the heart and the mind. Maybe a bit of joy, a bit of anxiety, a bit of surprise. I'm not supposed to be doing this right now. Whatever it was. So I'll be offering a few reflections tonight, and then next week there'll be the yearly forgiveness practice, and then I'll offer another talk afterwards. So it's this really interesting position of speech with forgiveness sandwiched in the middle, right? Feels kind of appropriate. But what I wanted to talk about kind of over these 2 weeks is really more about the journey to words, right? The journey to words, and specifically tonight, the aspect of listening as a preparation and a kind of preparation for speech. Right? So tonight, a reflection really on wise listening. Because for most of us, we can get so focused on kind of getting the words right, right? Getting it right on an exterior level, or even just working at the level of thought when we sit down. We're often just rather bombarded and consumed by this level of thought. So in kind of inquiring or reflecting on what it really means to listen, kind of allow ourselves first to drop below that level and start with the gesture of receiving. So it feels like kind of one fluid gesture. When we listen, we take in, we receive, we open, and then we offer back out in the form of words, actions, service, whatever it is. So we can't just separate that final piece, that final fruit at the end that is our words. It's come about through a whole movement of taking in, listening, making meaning, understanding, and then speaking, offering out, right? So a fluid gesture. And there's a wonderful dance between all of these polarities, you know, between the passive and the active, between the receptive and the expressive, between the yin and the yang. So giving both kind of equal time feels really skillful in terms of speech. It's not just about what do I say, but it's really about how am I listening? How am I receiving? And the path as we explore it really has this wonderful kind of integrative quality to it. Right? So if we pluck mindfulness kind of out of context, or pluck a specific technique out of context, it can seem like its benefits are kind of limited. But when we look at something kind of like the Eightfold Path, it's so like comprehensive and so integrative in that each factor is really closely related to the ones before it. So speech arises out of our view and intention, directly out of view and intention. It doesn't just pop out of thin air. It really gives us a clue into how the mind is operating. So I know when I first started practicing doing retreats, at the end of a 10-day retreat, kind of in a more traditional style, very kind of intensive retreat, there was this very sudden kind of drop afterwards when I had to integrate back into daily life. There was this feeling of being quite overwhelmed and at a loss, almost like a grieving process for leaving retreat and coming back into everyday life. And in that style, there was a lot of focus on the particular technique, and the instruction at the end was, well, keep the precepts, but good luck out there, you know? It's like, you know, do your best, good luck with that integration part or that life part, you know? So I felt like there wasn't much exploration or nuance of how does this relational piece fit in, of which speech is so much a part. So when we get to this middle part of the Eightfold Path, we're in right now, this speech, action, and livelihood, we're kind of right in the heart of relationship, right? How do we interact with one another? How do we interface with one another? So the Buddha had a lot to say about this. He wasn't so concerned, I don't think, about just individual people getting enlightened on their own. That was important, or being awakened on their own. But he was also very interested in creating communities in which his teaching could grow and thrive and continue. And so he gave a lot of thought and a lot of instruction around, how can I keep these communities harmonious? How can I keep them places of practice, places of safety, so people can actually inquire and really look deeply into what's true? So in that way, it's very useful, and this is kind of the brilliance of the precepts, to have some agreements or some understandings like set up ahead of time, right? Because in the heat of the moment, we kind of revert to the level of our conditioning. So I have I try to keep the parenting examples to a minimum, but it's a challenge with a five-year-old, because that's my world right now. But we have up in the refrigerator a list of our agreements for how to help create and maintain a healthy, safe household, right? So these are agreements based on our love for one another and our commitment to creating a household that we all want to be in. So they're very simple commitments. No hitting, because it hurts, right? No sword fighting, because it makes people afraid, right? No calling each other stupid, because it hurts feelings, right? So in some ways, it's not, I don't mean at all to be patronizing, but in some ways we make commitments to one another about what is going to ensure our safety over time, and speech is such a big part of that. So that when we're in the heat of the moment, when we're hungry, angry, tired, enraged, all we need to say, you know, as a parent, all I need to say is, remember our agreements. Remember the agreements that we made to one another. So the precepts have a very real kind of foundation, and wise speech, or refraining from false speech, is the fourth very important precept. And it's the one that most of us spend most of our time on, right? Is speech. We can get enraptured by drinking, stealing, sex, and all the rest of it, but we spend a lot of our time speaking. So how to bring care to this aspect of our experience by really remembering what our deepest intention is. So I know Tim went over kind of some other lines of inquiry based on the suttas. So some things that we can ask as we're about to speak. Is this true? Is this useful? Is this timely? Is this coming from a mind of kindness? Is this gentle or is this harsh? So these are also kind of momentary checks, momentary reminders, but also kind of inquiries into our own mind. So this aspect of listening, and often I talk about meditation or mindfulness as listening, as deep listening. So again, it's not listening just for the content of our minds, it's not listening just at the level of words, but it's a kind of full-bodied, open, felt experience of listening. So right now, I often offer this kind of invitation at the beginning of a talk. Is it possible to keep some attention rooted in the body as you're listening. So grounded in the body, because often we're reaching forward through the head, out the eyes for information, like trying to grasp, let me see if I can get this right. But is it possible to listen in a more full-bodied way that more resembles how the mind is when you're meditating silently? Right. So one way the Buddha talked about this is with the term sampajana, right? Sati sampajana, mindfulness and clear knowing or clear comprehension. And when we pay attention in this way, in this like deep way, like let me see what's here, inwardly, outwardly, let me really feel, not just a cursory recognition, but a really full knowing, we start to get a much broader sense of what's happening in the mind and heart. A broader sense of conditions that may have brought us to this moment and may have a future ripple effect. So in a very immediate moment-to-moment way, we're aware of the smoke. Right? We're aware of this quality of air or quality of mind. We're aware of how it touches our throat, how maybe it gives us a headache to some degree. We're aware maybe of fear that comes up, like what does this mean? Are people suffering in this moment, knowing they're suffering in this moment? So sati sampajana, this deep listening, allows us to know that this present moment, there were causes and conditions that led to this. There were actions that led to this. There are environmental forces at work that brought this into being. It just isn't just something that has arisen out of nowhere. So it's a full-bodied listening, but it's also a deepening understanding that things have this kind of lawful way, not always pleasant, but this lawful way of coming into being, and also leaving an effect over time. Leaving an effect over time. So this sati sampajana, body, speech, and mind, all interacting, all in this interplay. So Gil Fronsdale, a teacher in Northern California, says, it's good to remember that our speech arises out of the ecology of our inner life. If the inner life is well cared for, it's much easier to speak wisely. Right? So the speech arises out of the state of mind. So I know when I first started giving talks, there was such a fixation, mostly fear-based, onto getting the words exactly right. There's just this endless preparation in terms of how can I get these words exactly right. And slowly over time, it dawned that it's really not just about the words that are delivered. Like, to some degree, the words are helpful. And I've been with teachers who just read word for word, expressionless, the teachings, and that's beautiful, and I've gotten a lot out of that. But to some degree, we're also always transmitting a state of mind, right? We're always offering a state of mind to others. Has anyone ever been affected by another person's state of mind, even though they weren't speaking? Anybody? Today? Anyone? In the last hour? Yeah. So when we start to listen in this way, we realize it's not really just my personal mind, right? In some ways, it is like a collective human mind. We're pinging off of each other, reverberating. How I care for my mind has a huge impact on your experience as well. So my time in preparing for talks has been much better served by caring for my own mind rather than preparing the precision of the words. So wise speech isn't becoming a good orator, right? Isn't becoming a powerful, persuasive speaker. It's really about speech that's rooted in wisdom, rooted in wise understanding, rooted in a mind that's turned in the direction of kindness, compassion, inwardly and outwardly. But mostly we're so kind of seduced and drowning in this level of words, right? This just onslaught of information, that at the end of the day, our minds are exhausted, right? Anybody experience this? This like information, complete information overload. So to recognize that this verbal programming is just one level of things, again and again, just one level. We have the we have the bodily programming, we have the heart-mind programming, the level of emotion, perception, feeling, attitude, and this verbal programming, as compelling as it is just one aspect of our experience. So as we listen, we can feel this. And nearly all of the thinking is distorted, right? I've started to just think of it as diseased. This thinking is diseased and it needs care, right? It's not a personal failing or problem of mine, but it's a bit sick. You know? It needs some basic care. Sick in that maybe it's disconnected. Maybe that's a better way of saying it. So we can't expect that our speech will be otherwise if that's kind of the soil that it's coming out of. So the Thai meditation master Buddhadasa was asked, how should Westerners practice? He said, how should Westerners practice with this mostly continual kind of harsh and judgmental inner speech, this like tendency towards self-harshness and judgment? How should Westerners practice with these tendencies? And he said, first they should just be taken out into nature, into forests, into trees, and their whole practice should be enveloped or imbued with the quality of metta, or of loving kindness. So in some way they can feel kind of their own belonging and their own connection again, because they've forgotten it, forgotten their own connection. So before you even try any technique at all, is it possible to have this attitude of mind be one of caring, of recognition of our belonging, of our connectedness? I always thought that that was an interesting first step. So listening, as I was thinking about this, this quote from Rumi also came to mind, and as I was looking it up, so the quote is, sit first, be still, and listen. Sit first, be still, and listen, because you're drunk and we're all at the edge of a roof. Okay. Sit, be still, and listen, because you're drunk and we're all at the edge of a roof. Right? So we can think of, and this isn't meant to be another judgment, but this is this thinking, disconnected thinking, has this kind of intoxicated quality to it. And our collective situation at times can feel like we're at a precipice, we're at the edge of a roof. So as I was thinking about this quote and looking it up, I went outside, and as the way these things happen, there were two neighborhood boys, 8 and 10, who had climbed up onto the roof of our shed outside in the yard, like a freestanding shed. They found a way to climb up there, and they had decided they were going to rake pine needles off of the top of the shed with rakes. So this is a pretty high shed. And so they were wildly, maniacally raking, you know, on top of this roof. And they had just read this quote, and there's this moment of alarm, as there is often with kind of our collective situation at times, like, this out of control kind of feeling, what can I do? And so in that moment, what do? We pause, right? The instinct is to get off of there, you know, we've got to come down, you know, more fear-filled aversion. But this pause, I think because I was working on the talk, and thank you for trying to sweep off those pine needles. I appreciate that. And you need to come off of the roof, right? Right? So what we can do, and we recognize this kind of, you know, you can call it the monkey mind, you can call it a enthusiastic but rather heedless 10-year-old with a rake, this aspect of our mind that is sometimes well-meaning but a little disconnected, and say, okay, you know, appreciate the intention, but we need to come down. It's time to come down, right? It's time to come down and just listen for a minute. Just reconnect, just listen for a minute. So we can do that with kindness, with goodness. Inwardly and outwardly, we can do that when we notice that there's harm being done or, you know, potential danger. So it can feel often like we don't have the time to listen, like we don't have the time or the space to listen, but we really can't afford not to. Otherwise, we're just continuing to madly rake, right? Continuing to add kind of aversion to aversion. So it's already been a half an hour, and I'm just at the prelude to the talk. Yeah. What I wanted, I'll save most of this because I really want to hear from you also, but what I wanted us to reflect on together, and maybe you can take this into your practice over the next couple of weeks, was listening through this lens of wise intention, right? So wise intention is the factor that informs speech or gives it a good deal of its wisdom. So these aspects of wise intention are renunciation, letting go of what's harmful, right? Non-ill will. So thinking of ill will as, you know, grumpiness, crankiness, irritability, aversion, frustration, impatience. Ill will can sound a bit formal and archaic, but when we put it in terms like, you know, grumpy, disgruntled, impatient, we can understand it a little better. So renunciation, non-ill will or kindness, and harmlessness or compassion. So is it possible to listen to ourselves and to listen to another with these lenses or with these inclinations of mind? So our normal impulses, our impulse energy, our intentions are mostly towards wanting and fearing, right? We'll notice those intentions in various forms come up again and again. But when we're listening deeply with the idea of caring for the mind, in a way that we let go of what we know is harmful to ourselves and others, renunciation, making space. So renunciation as a way of making space. And also with non-ill will or kindness, caring for the mind, and harmlessness or compassion. So there are so many ways that we can renounce as we listen. And One of them that I'll just speak to briefly, when we're listening to someone, it's the belief that we know them already, right? I know who you are. I know these words, you know, people we've been living with for years. We know what's going to come out of their mouths. So I know this. So this assumption that we know someone, we know what's best for them. And Mary Oliver just has a lovely poem about this that just sums it up. And I'll read this because it just encapsulates it so beautifully. It's called The Whistler. All of a sudden, she began to whistle. By all of a sudden, and she wrote this about her partner, Molly Malone Cook, who she lived with for, I think, 40 years, maybe more. All of a sudden, she began to whistle. By all of a sudden, I mean that for more than 30 years, she had not whistled. It was thrilling. At first, I wondered, who was in this house? What stranger? I was upstairs reading and she was downstairs, as from the throat of a wild and cheerful bird, not caught but visiting. The sounds warbled and slid and doubled back and larked and soared. Finally I said, "Is that you? Is that you whistling?" "Yes," she said, "I used to whistle a long time ago. Now I see I can still whistle." And cadence after cadence she strolled through the house whistling. I know her so well, I thought. I thought. Elbow and ankle, mood and desire, anguish and frolic, anger too, and the devotions. And for all that, do we even begin to know each other? Who is this I've been living with for 30 years? This clear, dark, lovely whistler. So renouncing the belief that I already know you. Right? So renouncing our attachment to being right. So this is worthy of a whole talk in itself, but we'll notice those impulses, this, I know this, or this kind of positioning that is already asserting our opinion as someone speaking. It's already formulating a view in which I come out on top. Right? And this is related to what the Buddha identified as conceit, right? As mana, as this kind of distortion, or I prefer to think of it as disease of mind, that is always comparing ourselves to one another. So we're listening to someone, and instead of really listening, we're thinking, I'm better than that, or I've got that, I know that, I'm right about that. I'm better than, or I'm less than. You know, oh, they do that really well. I can't do that quite as well. I'm less than in some way. Or, I find this coming up in myself again and again, the same as, oh, I can relate to that. That's just like this, right? So it's bringing the reference again and again back to me and my positionality, referencing it all kind of back here and trying to find, like, where do I fit in relationship to this person? So noticing the mind scrambling, trying to identify, how am I in relationship to this person? So it's trying to find safety to some degree, right? So notice this, I picked my son up from a play date and they were having a humming contest, right? Who could be the best hummer? It was a hum off. They were each humming and he had concluded, oh, Baker is such a good hummer. He's so good at humming, but I'm a much better runner. I can run really, really fast. So already, with the sense of an independent self, there's just this constant comparing going on. Constant, how do I define myself in relation to each other. So we're not relating, we're positioning internally. We're finding our position. And this may feel terrible, you know? If we're on Facebook and looking at 100 people who are having a wonderful Hawaiian vacation and we're in the midst of depression, it can feel terrible. But it feels familiar and it feels like me. Yeah. Oh, I know this. This feels like me. So this is mana. This is conceit of self. And we can relinquish this. We can renounce this when we know it so well in ourselves and we know it leads to suffering. So the Buddha said, if one regards herself superior or equal or inferior by reason of the body that is impermanent, painful, and subject to change, what else is that than not seeing reality? Or if one regards herself superior or equal or inferior by reason of feelings, perceptions, volitions, or consciousness, what else is it than not seeing reality? If one does not regard herself superior or equal or inferior by reason of the body, the feelings, perceptions, volitions, or consciousness, what else is it than not seeing reality? What else is it than seeing reality? So when we feel these things going on as we're listening, this kind of becoming or positioning, we can always come back to the bodily sense that doesn't proliferate, right? The mind can get enraptured with its kind of activities, with its projections, with its views, but the body doesn't proliferate, right? And we can feel how the heart is being affected by those proliferations. We can feel the, you know, sensitivity to cause and effect, the residual, oh, this feels painful, this feels uncomfortable, this feels sad, this feels lonely. So this is an act of caring, this is an act of kindness towards ourselves. So Ajahn Suchito said, sometimes my kindness amounts to simply not holding on to the negative impression I have of someone or myself, right? So kindness as an intention doesn't need to be this grand, syrupy, outward flowing love. It can simply mean renouncing negativity, letting that negative impression not deepen and fester. Okay. So it's recognizing too that in another, this is wisdom imbued with kindness, kindness imbued with wisdom, recognizing that in another too, that in their words they bring with them this whole conditioning to that present moment. Whatever they're expressing is not intrinsically who they are, just as though what's arising in my own mind is not intrinsic to who I am, it's an arising in my own mind. So this is listening again beyond the level of words, underneath the level of words. So Naomi Shihab Nye, the Palestinian American poet, she writes, "The words under the words." It's another poem. And maybe I'll stop here after this, but if you can feel in this poem the kind of deep level of listening, wisdom, belonging, and kindness. She says this is for Siti Kadra, north of Jerusalem. She says, my grandmother's hands recognize grapes, the damp shine of a goat's new skin. When I was sick, they followed me. I woke from the long fever to find them covering my head like cool prayers. My grandmother's days are made of making bread, a round pat-pat and the slow baking. She waits by the oven watching a strange car circle the streets. Maybe it holds her son lost to America. More often, tourists who kneel and weep at mysterious shrines. She knows how often mail arrives, how rarely there's a letter. When one comes, she announces it, a miracle, listening to it read again and again in the dim evening light. My grandmother's voice says nothing can surprise her. Take her the shotgun wound and the crippled baby. She knows the spaces we travel through, the messages we cannot send. Our voices are short and would get lost on the journey. Farewell to the husband's coat, the ones she has loved and nourished, who fly from her like seeds into a deep sky. They'll plant themselves. We will all die. My grandmother's eyes say, Allah is everywhere, even in death. When she talks of the orchard and the new olive press, when she tells the stories of Joha and his foolish wisdoms, he is her first thought. What she really thinks of is his name. Answer if you hear the words under the words. Otherwise, it's just a world with a lot of rough edges, difficult to get through, and our pockets full of stones. Answer if you hear the words under the words. Otherwise, it's just a world with a lot of rough edges, difficult to get through, and our pockets full of stones. So if when we listen, we are letting go to the extent that we're able through recognition and care, letting go of the attachment to being right, the self-positioning, the belief that we really know another person, we're right there. Quieting the majority of our mental chatter as we're listening, right? And in that space of renunciation, so care, kindness, and compassion are coming to the fore. There's space for them. We can see them. We can feel them. Just leave it there for at least for now, and let's just take a minute and sit together. So listening inwardly and listening outwardly is a practice. It's a practice that leads to understanding, that precedes speech. And it's one very real way of caring for our own minds and the minds of those around us. So I appreciate your attention. Thank you for your attention. And I'd love to hear what your experience is right now. If there are questions, comments, what's arising from listening in this way? From that offering of words. Yeah. They may or may not. So the question is about friends who've been going through some difficult times, maybe in relationships, going through loss, and how do you apply wise listening or wise speech in those moments? I'm sure we all have our own kind of wisdom around this, our own practice around this. If we're listening through that lens of letting go of our own kind of self-referencing, self kind of preoccupation, like sometimes when we're listening to someone's loss, it brings up our own kind of anxieties about our own loss, our own potential loss, or we're kind of stuck in comparing or fixing or judging what they should do to get out of that. But when there's just a pure listening based on care and compassion, based on wisdom, there's this understanding that loss is a part of human life, right? It happens. And so when we're listening to someone who's in that state, we can just listen without having to make anything out of their experience, without trying to make it different, without trying to make it go away, without adding our judgment to it. Often we feel like there's something that we need to do to fix it. You know, I don't want you to have to feel this, is what we're saying, right? I don't want you to have to feel this. But maybe that's not the best thing. Maybe what's the most skillful, compassionate thing is to be right with that person as they're feeling it, bringing your full presence to that as it's happening. And then you can lend your mindfulness, your wisdom, and that just very simple renunciation of kind of like getting out of the way, you know, for those moments anyway. You can recognize, how am I being affected by this? But it's just hearing that this mind state is suffering. This is suffering. This is difficult. You know? So letting that be first and letting the words come out of that. But then they'll come from a very different place of then, well, you didn't really need them anyway, you know? Or, you know, let's go have some ice cream, which can be skillful, you know? But really what people crave more than anything is to just be heard in unconditional presence, right? Like, that's the biggest gift. I work with a lot of people at the end of their lives, work with a lot of elderly people with brain injuries and dementia, and where the thinking is distorted in a pretty severe way. And there's no way that I can be helpful or skillful at the level of just speech, right? It's absolutely impossible. You can't talk them out of their reality, you know? Oh, I've got to get out of it. You know, you can't talk them out of their reality. I can't insert my own reality, but they can absolutely feel the condition of my own heart and mind in those moments. They can feel care, and more than anything, they can feel non-judgment, right? What a lot of us are cowering from or bracing against is this feeling of being judged by others. Right? So it makes it almost impossible to listen, because we're rehearsing our response. We're trying to get to a place where we're safe and not judged. You know? But if we can really listen without judgment, even that is enormous. Even without, that shouldn't be this way. You shouldn't be this way. You shouldn't be having this experience. That's a huge amount of space that we're granting to other people. So... yeah. Okay.
Carrie, that was so beautiful. I was really touched and impacted by the whole talk and my experience and your experience. And what's really coming to me is the taking care of the mind so I can cause less harm to others' minds or experiences. And I've intellectually spoken this before, and I've heard it being said, that we have tender minds, and we need to toughen up our minds with the Dharma, you know, the Dharma's protection. But that didn't really connect with me, somatically, and I'm probably because I have a way to apply it. I'm thinking of, I'm applying this in speaking with a relationship with my brother, who we're going to be spending 4 days together with my dad's death in celebration of him. And he, you know, we think we know each other, though, you know, we don't see each other very often. And so this wonderful opportunity to really listen and not try to go there. That I think I know him. I know what you're gonna say, and because he thinks he knows me, and it just it is a real tender time, and there's going to be a lot of people, and this idea, this man's. Taking care of my mind, and including the pausing, which is so hard. But I think that the chink, the light is coming through, and that's the first to be able to practice that.
Yeah, great. So more of a reflection about this aspect of caring for our own minds, and in doing that, we're really caring for the minds of others. And as she's reflected on that in the past, it's been more of mindfulness as a protection, as kind of a toughening up or a strength, that maybe a guarding against difficulty. But this feels like a new way of considering it or reflecting on it, especially as she goes into difficult family situations where, you know, people with a long history, we have a lot of very quick triggers, the quickest, because they helped program them. So this reflecting on caring for one's own mind as also caring for another. And I think also, you know, really getting a sense of kindness as a strength is kind of revolutionary, but we can really get a sense of that in our own mind. Of the, you know, not necessarily a feeling of gushing love, because that's fluctuating, but a growing commitment, resolve to goodwill, you know, if that's easier, towards ourselves and others. That growing commitment is the strength. The returning to the intention again and again is the strength. It's like resolving on openness. What's that like, you know? That means we just come back to it again and again. Doesn't mean like, okay, I'm open. It's like, it's coming back to the intention again and again, and knowing that that's really where the power and ultimately the impact plays out, from the level of intention. Yeah. So play with that, experiment. Is this kind of brittle protectiveness, is that really safer? You know, it's a lot to play with. Yeah.
I really like the thought of being able to do something when I'm not doing anything to help when I have to do something, like my speech, because I find myself having unskilled speech and then regret, and then I have this resolve, well, next time I'm going to say something more wisely, and it seems so much easier to instead have a resolve of taking care of my mind so that when something arises, the speech will be wiser, rather than, I must remember when I open my mouth to be wise. And I had an experience this weekend where I was camping and somebody came to my campsite and asked if I had any extra. She said, oh, I heard you had extra boiling water. And I said, no, I don't. And I was boiling water at the time, but it wasn't boiled. And it was such an ungenerous thing to say. And I had a lot of regret afterwards. And I'm driving home, and I was listening to this Dharma talk on the way home, and they talked about how you should sort of incorporate generosity with everything you're doing. And I thought, well, I'm driving, how can I be generous? But all of a sudden I just really thought generous mind, and I could see somebody wanted to come in front of me, and I was like, please go ahead. And I thought, wow, it's true, like you can drive generously, and you can, if you sort of have that mind and that intention, then it can preempt, you know, person asking for boiling water.
Yeah. A lovely reflection again about being able to do something to take care of her own mind, even when she's doing nothing outwardly. So reflecting on a time in which perhaps she could have been more generous, and the kind of shame response that comes afterwards when we're kind of trying to apply these principles from the outside, like what I should do, what I should be like, you know? I always think of Rodney reading off the lists of a skillful Boy Scout, you know, loyal, trustworthy, brave, you know, and how that just felt pressure. So applied from the outside, and we'll talk in 2 weeks about that kind of regret, part of it that can be helpful, but the spasms of shame are not so helpful. So there can be a learning in reflecting afterwards, but you know, to some extent we do need the reminders on the fridge. We do need those kind of outward checks so we don't destroy ourselves often in the heat of the moment. But it is really much more about an inward cultivation. You know, the whole Eightfold Path is meant not just to be memorized and applied from the outside, but these are things to be cultivated, like over time, you know. And so we can cultivate, not just when we're ready to eat the fruit, but we're cultivating the soil all the time. And that's really productive work, you know, and it's nourishing for ourselves and others. Our practice can be nourishing for ourselves and others. It's not just another set of expectations. So that's, yeah, beautiful reflection. Thank you. Maybe one more quick, yeah. Yeah.
But also finding your own feet.
Yeah, yeah. So the question around basically being the recipient of unwise speech, right? So the list that I think Tim went over, true, useful, timely, you know, coming from kindness, like the opposite of that. Someone trying to fix, change, correct you in speech. How do you respond to that skillfully? So the Buddha's kind of high bar is, he said, it is possible to have someone speak to you in a way that is every definition of unwise and to still maintain kindness and compassion. Like, that is still possible. So I like to hold that out there as a possibility, and I'm in no way an expert or a master at any of this. I'm right there with all of you in the trenches trying to figure this out. But to, in that moment, you can still care for your own mind and that of the other. So it may be a time to very skillfully say, you know, thank you for your opinion. Is it possible to just listen right now? You know, I see you really, really want to help me. So you're acknowledging maybe partly a skillful intention, someone wanting to help. But right now, I would really prefer to be quiet for a little while. You know, or you can always say how you're affected by something. Right. So I see that you really want to help me right now, but that actually is making me feel more anxious. You know, some people just don't know. They're just trying to help. They're raking on the top of the roof, right? So I see you really are trying to help. Thank you for getting to those pine needles, but yeah, come down. So you can say a very firm, kind no. Yeah. And so you can say it externally, but more than anything, you can just recognize, that's coming from their conditioning. It's not who that person is. But I can also stay very clearly in my own experience and my own awareness. Don't get caught up in their words or opinions. It's just an opinion. It's just a view. It's just a view. Right. So all those are, but it's a practice. Yeah. Often we're very caught off guard, you know, by that. Yeah. So thanks all. This, I hope some of this was helpful. As we always say in this tradition, take what's helpful and leave the rest. The spirit of renunciation. Take what's helpful. Take one, if you got one phrase, one image, one maybe shift in how you've been reflecting on something, then it's worthwhile. So take it and use it in your own, use it in your own practice, what's interesting to you to explore, see for yourself. Okay, so I think we have, do we have announcements?